This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon, this is Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. Live hornbills, dead green sea turtles, gibbons, horns from dead rhinos, just some of the seizures made by authorities over the past 2 months alone. Dead or alive, these and more wildlife are still being actively traded all over Southeast Asia and the world. How do we even begin to combat these massive conservation crimes, which includes the illegal wildlife trade? So I'm going to discuss this and more with Elizabeth John, a Senior Communications Officer with Traffic Southeast Asia, an NGO which monitors the wildlife trade. Welcome, Elizabeth. How are you today?
Hi, Juliet. Thanks for having me on. I'm okay.
Yeah, nice to see you. As always, it's been more than a year since we caught up with you. Gosh, I think the last time we spoke was just at the start of this pandemic. How crazy these last 2 years have been. But it's good to have you on the show. Despite, I think, the pandemic, the wildlife trade seems to be thriving despite, you know, everything that's going on. Can we just talk about some of those recent seizures that we've been seeing in the headlines, right? So I know that on the 30th of August, the Department of Wildlife and National Parks, which is Perhelatan, they arrested two Malaysian men at KLIA as they attempted to smuggle 8 live hornbills. Can you remind us about this particular seizure?
Okay, so this was a bit of an unusual seizure because for the longest time, the world has been focused on the trade of hornbill parts, particularly the helmeted hornbill, which is a bird that has a head, which is not hollow. It's solid, and it is considered in many places as an ivory replacement. And, those were the birds that were targeted and seen in trade a lot. So it was mostly the parts. So when we saw the seizure in KLIA of 8 live hornbills, that was a little bit unusual for Malaysia. We've seen this kind of seizures a lot in Indonesia, in Philippines, in Thailand, in other parts of Southeast Asia. But for Malaysia, it was quite unusual, and we were quite glad that that seizure had been made, not only because the birds were saved, but suddenly it opens your eyes to the fact that, you need to be watching also the live bird trade. It doesn't always involve, pretty little songbirds, which people want to, keep as a pet or use in singing competitions. It also involves large, rare and endangered birds like hornbills.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the hornbills that were intercepted, right, all those species were native to Malaysia, right? So meaning they were caught over here.
Yes, very likely, because Malaysia has 10 of the world's 30 or so hornbill species. It is very likely that birds were from here. Although, further investigations might actually show you that, they are from elsewhere in the region. Okay. That is also possible. We don't really know all the species that were seized, but from photographs we can tell that there were a few rhinoceros hornbills, and we also saw what looked like very young helmeted hornbill.
Yes, I think that's what the headlines were saying, that there was a baby helmeted hornbill, and that implies some not so great things about what might have happened to the baby's parents, perhaps, right? Because they are dependent on their parents for a long time before they actually come out of the nest and all of that, isn't it?
Yeah, so hornbills are quite unusual in that sense. So they a pair of hornbills finds a hole in a tree, a large enough hole where the mother lays her eggs and waits for the baby to hatch. And the mother and the baby are actually stuck in that hole for a bit. The hole is closed up to a certain extent. The male bird is the one that does the finding food and feeding. Yeah. And the mother and baby stay in the hole for quite a while until the baby is ready to fly, usually. Yeah. So the poachers may well have got to the hatchling's nest itself, this would have meant some level of destruction of the nest, and possibly, the mother bird would definitely defend her chicks, so, they might have harmed the bird, but it's also possible that they could have gotten the chicks without harming adult birds.
Okay, yeah. I mean, we will never know, isn't it? But there's just, yeah. And I think if I remember correctly, like hornbills tend to go back to the same nesting ground. So it's possible that, you know, these poachers have been watching and waiting and, you know, who knows, right? It's really quite...
Yes, they do. Research shows that they do go back to the same tree, actually. The same pair goes back to the same tree every time. Yeah. So it's known behavior, and poachers are certainly waiting and watching.
Yeah. And, you know, I was reading a traffics report about this, right? And according to you guys, anyway, the hornbills were most likely headed to Bangladesh and suspected onwards to Europe, right? And I was reading that you guys thought that this arrest pretty much confirmed suspicions that you already had, that, you know, live hornbills are trafficked from Malaysia to intercontinental markets, right?
Actually, the link with Bangladesh and Europe, that came out of the Perhelitan press release, okay. Because they are the ones who are talking to the two men who were arrested and, you know, finding out the details behind the seizure.
Okay.
But what it confirmed for traffic was that, you know, the trade in live hornbills is really something that needs to be watched. So far, we've been seeing a fair bit of it between Indonesia and the Philippines. So hornbills going from Indonesia to the Philippines and vice versa. Some hornbills that only occur in certain parts of the Philippines going to Indonesia. So that means, you know, there's a collector somewhere who really, really knows what they want, and they have, you know, particularly asked for that bird. We've also seen information that says where traders are talking about birds from hornbills from Indonesia going on to places like China. There have been also cases where there was, I think, a Russian who was trading heavily in all kinds of animals from Southeast Asia, and one of the animals mentioned were hornbills. So you know that these things go around often, you know, this case confirmed it for Malaysia. We haven't seen a case like this where, you know, eight, which is quite a large number for critically endangered birds, you know, to be transported live out of the country.
Okay. All right. So these, I mean, what you mentioned were some of the indications or the previous cases as well, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay, that's quite worrying. But I mean, okay, so that's the hornbills. And then, you know, very shortly after, you know, in September, I think it was the 9th of September, the country's largest rhino horn seizure since 2018 took place, right? Can you remind us what happened there?
So this was a very interesting case where Perhelitan successfully followed a lorry that was exiting the KLIA area. And based on intelligence, gave chase, and they stopped the lorry at the roundabout near the mosque in the KLIA area.
Okay.
And they searched the lorry and found these 50 pieces of rhino horn. So it's not all full horns. Some of them are parts and pieces or fragments. Mm-hmm. But, you know, 50 is still quite a significant number.
Yeah.
And it is the first time Malaysia is actually arresting someone rhino horn-related seizure. So we've had seizures before of an equal number of horns, but that's been a case where it's been found in cargo, or, you know, in previous cases where it's unclaimed luggage and things like that. Or, you know, shipments that come into port and no one gets caught. But this is the first time somebody is actually caught. Very keenly awaiting to see them brought to court and, you know, some charges brought against these people. And this also provides an opportunity for agencies like Perhelitan to really look into where it's coming from, where it's going to, who the buyers are, who the middlemen are, you know, to really figure out this trade chain. Because, you know, you can seize as much as you want, but if there's no arrest, you never get to find out the whole story.
Yeah. And I think, you know, it was quite ironic, right, that the seizure came not too long before World Rhino Day, which was in September. Can you just tell us about how bad the situation is for rhino populations worldwide? We know what's the case in Malaysia, but, you know, how is it worldwide as well?
The rhino story has never been a very happy story. It's a bleak outlook for rhinos all over the world. So we have an estimate by another organization called Save the Rhinos that looks at the situation worldwide, and they estimate that about 9,500 rhinos have been lost to poaching in the last decade. You know, in Malaysia, we lost the last two Sumatran rhinos that we had in 2019. The Javan rhino in Malaysia went extinct quite some time ago. And worldwide, when you look at the Javan and Sumatran rhino populations, they're only in Indonesia. And there are 80 individuals of each species left, or less, 80 or less.
Okay.
So, yeah, it's really not looking good. For the Javan rhino in Indonesia, things have been looking up, in the sense that the numbers have grown over the years, because they are, you know, very much in one place, in a very protected area, and the situation is very under control. But, you know, you can imagine the vulnerability of that animal. It is only in one place on Earth, and anything happens, that population is gone. So it's not a good situation all around.
Yeah, and I think even the fact that there's so few of them, that's fueling the trade even more, isn't it? People just want their hands on it. And what is both Malaysia and Southeast Asia role in this illicit global trade of rhino horns? What sort of role do we play in all of it?
Well, Southeast Asia does play a little bit of a source role, but much less, because as I mentioned earlier, you know, the number of individuals are very small, and they're very, very heavily guarded, and the areas are very heavily patrolled. More and more, Southeast Asia is playing a role as a transit for rhino horns from Africa to other parts of Asia, or as a consumer country. And this is largely happening in places like Vietnam, where the rhino horn has been in demand over the past couple of years, or maybe over the past decade or so, as a hangover cure, as a gift, a luxury gift to show your business partner or somebody you want to impress, that you can get your hands on, you know, something really rare and really valuable. So these are the roles that Southeast Asia plays, largely as a conduit to other parts of the world. But there are some countries in Southeast Asia where rhino horn is a consumer demand item.
Okay. All right. So both ways, I suppose, right? And as you guys also pointed out, right, seizures like these at KLIA, they sort of, like this one at KLIA, illustrate the real threat of the international demand on these species, right? But also, more positively, the vital role stakeholders like Perhelitan have in preventing this illegal trade, right? Could you elaborate on that?
So when you look at the smuggling event, it starts at the point where an animal is taken out of the wild, all the way through to it being taken apart, packaged, either sold locally or put on a ship or plane or given to someone to carry across a border, international border. And then it reaches the destination country, where it can be repackaged and transported somewhere else or sold within that destination country. And, you know, throughout this trade chain, you have so many people involved. You have the poachers, you have the traders, you have the transporters, you have the middlemen, you have the big kingpins who are overseeing or watching this whole thing going on. You have banks involved in the sense of, you know, money has to be taken out and deposited somewhere, or, you know, some financial services have to be used. You've got all kinds of people involved in this trade chain. And so everyone at every point has an opportunity to make a difference, to stop this. That's where the biggest part is usually played by an enforcement agency like Perhelitan, because they have the powers, because they have the intelligence, and this is their core duty. You know, it's really important, and it's also important that you do it at every point, or you try at every point, to make sure that nobody benefits from, or as few people as possible benefit from this trade. I mean, it'd be best if, ideally, if protected areas can actually be fully protected and you can prevent the animal from even being taken away in the first place. Because remember, the point of all of this is to conserve species.
Yeah.
But, you know, just because the animal has already been poached doesn't mean you stop trying to stem the trade or to, you know, deny the demand that is, you know, growing all the time. So everyone along the trade chain, and especially the enforcement agencies, play a very, very important role.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, we're just going to go for a quick break now, but when we come back, you know, we'll just do a quick refresher course on, you know, how bad or how huge this trade actually is. I'm speaking today to Elizabeth John. She's the Senior Communications Officer at Traffic Southeast Asia. We're talking about how we can even start to tackle or combat these conservation crimes. We'll have more after this quick break. You're listening to Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture. I'm Juliet Jacobs. Joining me on the line today is Elizabeth John. She's a Senior Communications Officer at Traffic Southeast Asia. Traffic is, of course, a non-governmental organization working in all 10 Southeast Asian countries, monitoring the wildlife trade. And that's exactly what we're talking about today, the wildlife trade and how we can combat, you know, these conservation crimes. You know, for me, Elizabeth, I follow you guys on social media, right? Especially on Facebook. And it's just updated almost daily, right? With seizures of wildlife, dead and alive, you know, all everything related to the wildlife trade. And I guess, you know, just proof of our seemingly insatiable demand for wildlife, right? For consumption status, as you mentioned earlier, traditional medicine, you name it, right? Maybe we can just do a quick reminder for people who aren't so familiar with this trade. How big is the business of wildlife crime? You know, can you do a 101 for us?
Sure. Wildlife crime is a big industry. And when I use the term big, it's not just in terms of the value. You will find out there are lots of different estimates from a couple of million to hundreds of millions, or even in the range of billions. It really depends on who's doing the estimate and how much information they have. But the fact is, it's actually very difficult to do this kind of an estimate because it is an underground business. It's clandestine. Yeah. So anything that you go by is really an estimate. But the bottom line is that it makes people a lot of money, this illegal business. When I say big, it's not just in terms of this dollar value. It's also in terms of the volumes that are being traded. So if you look at, just take Malaysia, for instance. In 2020, we had a 6-ton seizure of pangolin scales.
Oh, yes.
You know, we had, and then, you know, if you look a little further to Singapore, they've had one of the world's biggest seizures of pangolin scales. And, you know, we've had these 50 rhino horn pieces seized. We've had, I think just last week, Hong Kong seized something close to 10 tons of shark's fin, illegally traded shark's fin from protected species. So the numbers that you're talking about are just never small. It's always big. And in terms of volume, it's really making a huge impact on species everywhere. Yeah, we are no longer in a situation where we are taking one or two for our own use. But, you know, it's really large. It's a commercial business. It's profit-driven. It's demand-driven. And that's what we mean, say, wildlife trade is huge and has huge impacts.
Yeah, I mean, people put it up there as, you know, it's as sophisticated as any criminal network we're going to find out there, right? Including drugs or whatever. It's up there with all of that. It's huge. And I remember speaking to you about this before, you know, what we have, all the stats we have is just a fraction of what's actually happening, right? The true magnitude of the trade, because like you said, these are only the successful seizures that we have data on, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, what we know is from what is publicly reported and what the authorities have managed to catch, or from our monitoring of things like online trade, you know how widespread it is. But really, it's the tip of the iceberg because of the manner in which this trade is carried out. It's secret. It's quietly done with people who know how to get things or who know where to get things. And when you actually, for instance, when authorities catch somebody and asked the backstory about how long they've been in the business. You know, you find this guy has, you know, already been trading tigers, say, for 6-7 years. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, this is not the first shipment of pangolin scales that they have made. You know, this is probably the fourth or the fifth. Or you have, you know, some really very big names that have been arrested across Asia. And they have been operating for you know, dozens of years. Mm. So what you know is really the tip of the iceberg.
Okay. And Malaysia, of course, is sadly a hotspot in this multi-billion dollar global trade, right, in illegal wildlife. Am I correct? And can you just remind us why we have this very dubious distinction?
Yeah, we do have the dubious distinction because we have been a source country, a transit country, and also a consumer country. It's one of those roles that unfortunately we play, you know, on quite a big scale. But it's not unique to Malaysia, I'm sad to say. It's really a feature of the whole of Southeast Asia because there is still a lot of wildlife in Southeast Asia, and there is also a huge demand within Southeast Asia. And we saw that as incomes went up in Southeast Asia, as the region developed, there was more and more of this demand for items that actually aren't cheap. Mm. It cost quite a bit. Malaysia is probably more prominent because it plays all three roles. So that's not the case for every single country in Southeast Asia. But I can say that Malaysia is not alone in this problem. It is a problem that is faced throughout the region.
Okay. And, you know, has the pandemic, I mean, which we know, right, which is widely believed anyway to have jumped from animals to humans, right, is a zoonotic disease. Has that affected people's attitudes about trade in wildlife, you know, especially wildlife consumption? I mean, do you think it has helped put wildlife trafficking back on the world's policy agenda?
It has, to a small extent, put trafficking on the agenda. Because of the nature of the pandemic, you know, it's still the human loss of life and the great race to find a vaccine and deliver these vaccines. And, you know, those were the bigger issues. But the whole thing about wildlife trafficking and wildlife consumption has been at the back of everybody's mind, and it is somewhat in the public eye, but not that high. Because, I mean, one of the reasons why I say that is because you look at the way people still traffic wildlife, particularly wild meat. There have been a few wild meat seizures in the region. Mm. It shows you that not everyone is scared, and certainly the traffickers aren't scared.
Okay.
You know, this is still the way they make money, and they know the loopholes, and despite the movement restrictions of the pandemic, they've still been able to, you know, get stuff through to a point where, you know, it's seized, and then that's when, you know, the rest of us realize, oh, it's still going on, people are still consuming wild meat, are still demanding wild meat. But, you know, having said that, there was a recent study where our partner organization, WWF, and a research body called GlobeScan took a look at the perceptions about pandemic and the links to wildlife in a couple of countries, namely China, Myanmar, Thailand, the US, and Vietnam, right? And it was really only in China and Vietnam that the public that was surveyed consistently considered consumption of wild meat an issue and wanted something specifically done about that, you know, meaning, you know, some action on wildlife trafficking and trade. It wasn't the case that it wasn't important in the other countries, but it was lower on the rung for them. You know, for them, it was more a case about doing more research to find more vaccines or cures, or generally being kinder to nature. There was a sense that, you know, a lot of what's ailing us is being caused by our treatment of nature.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I, you know, I was reading also wildlife experts noted that the online trade remained robust throughout the pandemic. Poaching in some locations actually increased, you know, from your data, from what you guys have been seeing from traffic. Would you agree with that assessment?
It's very hard to say because it's a two-year period and it's a very special circumstance. So it's not yet possible for us to say that, you know, there was a big rise or there was a big drop. What we can say is that we noticed that at the beginning of 2020, when the pandemic was at its first at its height, we didn't see so many of the large-scale seizures that came by containerized cargo. And that's probably because of the movement restrictions and the level of scrutiny on border movements.
Okay.
But as time moved on, we started seeing that happening. And that's been happening a little more in towards the end of 2021 now. The other thing that we noticed was throughout this period, 2020 and 2021, it's not like there wasn't people trading in wildlife. People were still trading in wildlife. Seizures were still being made. So you know that it has continued and people have found a way around it. What we can't say is that, you know, is it going up? Is it more? Is it less? That will take a little bit more time and research.
Okay. All right. Yeah. I guess it's too early to say. Yeah. Elizabeth, the last time that we caught up, we were discussing a report which was titled Southeast Asia at the Heart of Wildlife Trade, which kind of detailed the factors that are allowing the illegal trade to flourish, right? The report stated there is no shortage of collaborative tools and platforms to be employed to deal with this problem, yet the overall progress made to stem the illegal wildlife trade is slow and often lacks coordination. I think that's something that we were talking about a little bit before the break as well, you know, how many different moving parts there are to this, right? Do you think that's still the case? Do you think it's exacerbated even more by the pandemic and, you know, other sort of priorities at the moment?
You know, in terms of priorities, I don't think, addressing wildlife trade has been
ever
at the top ever. You know, it will always be economic issues, you know, putting food on the table, you know, maintaining a roof over the head kind of issues that will always take precedence. And with the pandemic, it was all about keeping safe and getting medical treatment and vaccine. But it did give a little bit of a push to really, because of the link between wildlife and the disease, that it gave reason to governments to look at it a little bit more. Mm-hmm. We did see a couple of governments in the region make statements saying that they would take, make a pledge that they would take things more seriously, make declarations about sale of wildlife in markets, in open markets in some places. And we did see an uptick in monitoring and seizure. But a lot of this is, again, hampered by the same old problems that have been faced in this area. There is still a lack of manpower for enforcement agencies. It's still lack of funding. It's still not the biggest priority. So the political will is not always there in all countries at the same level. Mm-hmm. And there still needs to be a lot more multilateral, bilateral work because the trade is not just within the country. It's very often between borders and borders. What this pandemic has shone a light on really is the need for more countries to be cooperating and collaborating on enforcement and intelligence on this. Otherwise, you know, it's just never going to end.
Okay. And, you know, in anything to do with wildlife trade, the illegal wildlife trade, we always talk about CITES, right? And they regulate both the legal and illegal trade in wild species of both flora and fauna. But they are not intended to be a crime-related convention, and it's quite limited in some ways. Am I correct? Maybe you could explain to people who aren't so familiar about CITES, you know, what it actually can do.
So CITES is, in very basic terms, an international agreement that countries sign, and they choose to abide by the rules set up by CITES. And the rules set up by CITES are simply to make it clear what species of wild plants and animals can be traded or may not be traded. And if they can be traded, what are the regulations for that trade? So, you know, when the country signs on to CITES, they agree to abide by this common decision that is made by over 170 countries around the world.
Sure.
And it is up to the country who becomes a party to this agreement to enforce those rules and regulations within their borders and in terms of imports and exports. Mm. So that's basically what CITES does. It is by agreement. It is what the rest of the world agrees to. It is incumbent upon the country to enforce it.
Yeah, so there's no like they don't have enforcement powers as such, yeah. Right? It's like a lot of the treaties that we have all over the world. Do you think having CITES has been effective, you know, in somehow countering the illegal wildlife trade? Has it been helpful?
Well, it is the best tool that we have at the moment.
Okay.
Of course, you know, there are many countries that express their unhappiness with the way things have been done, or, you know, they feel it can be strengthened in some way. But it's, as you said, it's the same issues that you face with any kind of international treaty. But it is the best tool we have at the moment that applies to a large, large number of countries. Mm-hmm. Again, as I say, how effective it is, it's how well the country wields powers that CITES allows you. You know, so every country, for instance, must enact a law within their borders to enforce CITES. Requirements. If you do this well as a member of CITES, then, you know, the convention is working for you in a good way. If you don't make use of it, if you don't enact this law within your country and maintain only legal trade across your borders, then, you know, it's really, to some extent, an individual country's fault. Mm. So, it's you know, there are options there for you, and it's really how you want to use it. And, you know, it's CITES has had some good impacts. One example I can give you is in Thailand.
Okay.
So Thailand was a country where ivory was very openly available for sale for the longest time. And one of the problems around this was Thailand allowed the sale of ivory from dead domestic elephants.
Okay.
Asian elephants, right? So elephants that have been kept in captivity in Thailand, and if they've died, the tusks can be taken and developed into, made into all kinds of products and so on. But at the same time, there were a lot of African elephant ivory or tusks being smuggled into Southeast Asia. And some of this, you know, you can see in the open markets. Being sold everywhere. And in countries like Thailand, their law only protected the Asian elephant. It did not protect the African elephant.
Okay.
So, you know, and when all these products come into a market, you can't, you know, as a shopper or even a monitor or an inspector, you can't go to a, you know, jewelry shop and look at the shelf and say, okay, this is African elephant, that is Asian elephant. There's no way for you to, you know, really, really tell. Although enforcement officers were being trained to identify things, you know, there was still for court purposes, if you're going to charge somebody or arrest someone, you would have to go through a whole DNA test process to check which was Asian and which was African. And then you could only then could you take action. So, you know, this made the whole process really, really difficult and ineffective. Mm. But what happened was because of the threat of sanctions via CITES, you know, because this problem was going on for a long time, and CITES told Thailand that, you know, you have to do something about this. Otherwise, there is a possibility that we will have sanctions against you. Hmm. And with this threat of sanctions, you know, Thailand changed its law to protect African elephants. It started a whole process of registration where people who had ivory were called to come out, register, do a DNA test, check where this ivory was from. They also implemented a stockpiling system. They went out and enforced the law. You know, suddenly there was a situation where you walked into Bangkok markets and there was hardly any ivory available.
Okay.
And the ones that were on the shelves were, you know, properly registered, coded. I mean, of course, it doesn't mean that, you know, traders are all telling the truth. You know, the enforcement in Thailand is still ongoing to check that everyone is following the rules. But the whole easy availability suddenly just, you know, disappeared. And in that sense, scientists has been effective.
Okay.
Again, you know, it's a convention that is managed by the countries themselves. So it's really up to the countries to make it work.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And for it, you know, for the countries to put this as a priority, because it is, you know, very much important. But like you said, other sorts of priorities are the ones that usually take precedence. Corruption, that's a huge one, right? Especially anything to do with the illegal wildlife trade. I think every stage in the illegal trade chain is affected. Poaching, illegal harvesting, transportation, as you mentioned just now, you know, right up to the sale and laundering of proceeds, right? So I guess, you know, in addition to the measures called for in these sorts of international and regional resolutions and treaties, what other efforts do you think are still needed to address corruption, particularly here in Malaysia? And we know it's happening, right? We've seen proof of that as well.
Yeah, you have corruption happening at every point in the trade chain, as I mentioned earlier, you know, anywhere along the line. Mm. And it doesn't just involve enforcement agencies. It also involves private actors, like people in the logistics and transport industry.
Yeah,
this is why we are working with everybody along this trade chain to address these issues. But one of the major things that most people are recommending now as a quick way to address corruption within the wildlife trade system is to put in place a lot of automated systems. Okay. For instance, permits. Mm-hmm. If permitting becomes an automated system, there is less opportunity for money to exchange hands in order to legalize things.
Okay.
It doesn't mean it doesn't happen at all, but there is a better chance for you to control the situation, and there is less human involvement in, say, for instance, the passing of permits.
Got it.
And not just permits, but in many other systems, there is a recommendation for it to be more automated rather than to depend on a human decision. So you take the temptation out of, you know, out of people's hands. That's one of the major things. But we are seeing things happen in different ways. For instance, through the arrest and prosecution process in Malaysia. So we've had a few cases now of people being caught, arrested and charged for bribing enforcement officers who have caught them on various illegal wildlife crime charges. I think we had couple of cases involving MMA officers, where MMA officers were on the one hand, there was a case where MMA officers were charged for accepting bribes, and the following year we had a case where MMA officers reported that a group of Vietnamese fishermen had tried to bribe them when the fishermen were caught fishing in Malaysian waters and without the necessary permits and documents. So we've also seen this case with in Sarawak and in Sabah, where court cases have been brought against people who have tried to bribe government officials for letting them off on crime cases. So you do see things like this happening. You see MECC getting involved in a lot of these cases.
Okay.
And also, very, very encouraging, we are seeing the police take up money laundering cases under the Money Laundering Act for wildlife criminals.
Okay. So some positives there, I suppose. And, you know, I just want to go back to something you said, right, that involves so many different people, right? And banks, I mean, do you think they play an important role in this fight against the illegal wildlife trade? Because I was reading this article about how following the financial trails of wildlife traffickers, that could be one of the most effective ways to identify sort of broader criminal networks, right? So the author, Timothy Chun, said that the responsibilities that financial services organizations have to detect and fight money laundering, as you were talking about earlier, which of course is inevitable in this trade, right, also apply to illegal wildlife trafficking, right? What are your thoughts on that?
It is I mean, we think it's absolutely absolutely important that all kinds of financial institutions take a look at this and get involved in helping. And this is something that Traffic has been working on for several years now. Like corruption, financial crime is an enabling factor in wildlife, illegal wildlife trade. We produced, not too long ago, we produced a case digest. It was an analysis of several case studies from around the world, looking at financial flows and payment mechanisms behind wildlife and forest crime. Mm. It's very interesting. If you look at that report, it's very condensed and summarized, but it provides you a very interesting picture of all the various methods wildlife criminals use to transfer money, to make payments, and how following some of these little breadcrumbs, will lead you to, really, really unexpected places and people. And the report also, brought up a lot of red flags for banks and for financial institutions, what they should be looking out for when they do their auditing and, forensic accounting, just checking to see what's happening.
Yeah.
With money flows, what red flags to look for, where the vulnerabilities are, what a criminal network diagram might look like, I think that the most interesting thing was the wide range and types of payment and laundering techniques that were used, it gives you a very, very different picture of the people involved, of the manner of trade, how trade is done, and who's actually behind the trade, because you can have a front man for a company, but when money is transferred, money is really transferred to the person who probably is backing the whole business. So it could be quite a different person from those named on, when you do a company search, who's the director, things like that. So there's a lot of things you can really find out that is not apparent through other methods of investigation.
Mm-hmm. So really some due diligence needs to be done, forensic report accounting needs to be done as well, right? It shouldn't close their eyes to this very, very important role that they play. I'm afraid we're running out of time, Elizabeth, but just to end on a more positive note, what are the things that we're doing right? What are the things that we're doing well, to combat the illegal wildlife trade?
One of the things that I do want to mention is, you talked about collaboration and working together and using the platforms that they are. Mm. One of the things Malaysia is doing right is the Ops Bersepadu Khazanah, where a couple of years ago, the Royal Malaysian Police decided to get involved in enforcing wildlife crime, which is something they hadn't done previously. Mm-hmm. And although the initial impetus for this was the number of, the very, very low number of tigers that we have left, the wild tigers that we have left in Malaysia. But they've expanded their work to cover all kinds of wildlife and also forest crime. And this has borne huge results. And it really speaks to the need for Malaysia to use the same model when it is working with other countries in the region, and to continue to use these kinds of models, or in fact institutionalize them so they don't disappear. Mm-hmm. You can have a task force where everyone's working happily together for a couple of years, and then suddenly, when finances are low or priorities change, then it fizzles out. We do hope that they will find a way to institutionalize it and to continue working in a concerted manner in this way, because this task force actually comprises many different enforcement agencies that all come together to work on wildlife trade issues, because that is the nature of wildlife trade. It involves so many different types of crime and so many different types of businesses,
yeah,
and industries, and to be able to pool manpower that way, finances, resources, and also attention in that manner is quite amazing. They have conducted hundreds of raids, arrested thousands of people for wildlife crime. They've pushed, many of these cases have come up in court. And as I mentioned earlier, we've seen quite a few anti-money laundering cases coming up as a result of this work, and a lot of property and assets forfeited from wildlife criminals through this process. And that is one of the things that Malaysia is doing right, and we do hope to see them continue and take it further.
All right. And, you know, just really to conclude, how can people get involved, you know, in preventing the illegal trade in wildlife and wildlife parts? You know, how can we support the work that Traffic does in particular?
Well, it's easy to become discouraged when you hear about, all these dead animals and, and things like that. But there is something very, very simple that everyone can do. And that is, first and foremost, when they are faced with a situation where they can buy wildlife or wildlife parts, say no. That is the first thing you can do. And it is powerful because it is now consumers who drive the demand and drive the poaching. If nobody asks for the item, no one has to go out and look for it and sell it and make money on it. The other thing that people can really, really do is to report wildlife crime. Report it to, now that we have quite a few agencies working on this area, you can report it to police, you can report it to Perhelitan, they have a hotline, you can report it to the MICAT Wildlife Crime Hotline, and with the MICAT Wildlife Crime Hotline, you can do this anonymously. We don't ask for your details, we just ask for what you saw and what you know. The other thing you can do is give your time and if financial support is possible, do donate to wildlife agencies and organizations.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining me today, Elizabeth. I've been speaking to Elizabeth John, the Senior Communications Officer at Traffic Southeast Asia. If you'd like to find out more about the work that Traffic does, just head to traffic.org or follow them on social media. And if you miss any part of today's interview, you can always download the podcast at bfm.my/earth, or you can find it on the BFM app. This has been Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.